Produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Rose Katapchi. Our theme music was composed and produced by Alan Weatherhead. Teddy Wilson manages our Tumblr page, where you can find sights and sounds from FSRN's global reporters. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.
The time is 6 p.m. and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio. Please stay tuned for Labor Radio at 6, and at 6:30 it's Prison Pipeline, followed by Hard Knock Radio at 7.
The KBOO Board of Directors elections are underway. KBOO members can vote for up to 4 candidates. Ballots were mailed in mid-August. If you think you are a KBOO member and have not received a ballot, email membership director Andrew Geller at membership@kboo.org or call 503-231-8032, extension 207. Non-members can join KBOO and receive a ballot to vote. Just go to kboo.fm and click donate on the top right-hand corner. The annual meeting is Sunday, September 15th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Matt Dishman Community Center at 77 Northeast Knott Street in Portland. You can mail back your ballot or bring it to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Ballots must be postmarked by September 10th or cast at the annual meeting by 2:40 p.m. to count. Get informed, get involved, and vote. Thanks.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Oregon Council 75, representing over 25,000 Oregon public and private sector employees, families, and communities, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members since 1942. More information at www.OregonAFSCME.com.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
Welcome to Labor Radio on KBOO with your hosts, Meredith and Megan. Tonight we'll be discussing the status of the longshore worker lockout and the recent ILWU decision to leave the AFL-CIO with labor activists Jamie Partridge and Joe Burns. We'll also begin to tackle questions around Syria by interviewing Seamus Cook, a prolific writer and local activist. But first, in other news, we have been reporting on the fast food worker strikes that have swept the country in previous months. And last week in the headlines, over 100 workers and allies were arrested in a day of action that continues to press for a living wage, among other demands. Organizers say another large demonstration is expected to take place on Black Friday. This weekend on September 7th, Occupy Portland's bike swarm joined postal protectors to block a private mail truck leaving the Mount Hood Distribution Center of the United States Postal Service, demanding that postal management stop subcontracting the trucking of the people's mail. Claiming concerns about safety, cost, and corruption, the blockaders left after police ordered them to disperse. No arrests were made. Calling themselves the postal protectors for the 99%, these protesters have blocked or interrupted Dill Star mail trucks 4 times this summer, with people, with a car, and on Saturday, with bikes. Next, we have an excerpt from Jamie Partridge's recent presentation on the ILWU struggle at Portland State University.
The International Longshore and Warehouse Union has been locked out for a number of months. by the grain companies, and last Friday announced the split from the AFL-CIO. What's happening with the ILWU is critical to the entire working class, and particularly the labor movement. It's been a model for 80 years of a militant left-led union. It's at the choke point of American trade on the West Coast, where it, you know, shutting down the ports on the West Coast, which it can do, will stop Walmart in its tracks, will stop the grain companies. Well, they won't. Their profits will go away. So now, the ILWU has been suffering scabbing, first time in 80 years that their work has been done by scabs. Just a quote from Jack Heyman's article, ILWU's militant history shows that mass labor mobilizations can stop scabbing. What's at stake here is the future of the ILWU, of the entire labor movement. If employers can attack what has historically been the most militant trade union in the U.S., without any unified response from organized labor, then the obvious question is, where is the trade union movement heading? If unions like the operating engineers and now the master's mates and pilots union can waltz across union-sanctioned picket lines without a qualm and the head of the AFL-CIO remains silent, then what kind of labor movement do we have? So this chapter started in Longview, where the local responded to an attack on its jurisdiction by the EGT, this transnational grain corporation. In classic ILWU fashion, it blocked the grain train. It dumped the grain in the tracks twice. They cleared the docks of scabs. On September 8, 2011, they shut down the ports on the West Coast. But facing jail and $300,000 in fines, and I would. Also to quote from Jack Heyman's article, fearing threats from Democratic Party friends of labor like President Obama, his Coast Guard and Homeland Security, as well as Washington's Governor Gregoire's mustering of police forces and mounting fines, union tops capitulated. And the EGT management, this is again from Heyman's article, won their demands, cutting out job dispatch through the union hiring hall, which is the basis of the ILWU's power. One in the militant 1934 West Coast Marine strike, elimination of all shift clerks jobs, a minimum of 12-hour shifts, the removal of the union operator from the grain loading console, which is now done by management, no grievance machinery or work stoppages for safety, allowing work to continue behind union picket lines with scabs and managers. So this concessionary contract that was imposed by the International on the Local 21 in Longview rippled out into the other grain companies, United Grain and Columbia Grain, attempting to get the same kind of a contract with Vancouver and Portland locals. Proposals were voted down, but the companies implemented their proposal and then locked out the workers, locked out Vancouver first and then Portland. There's been no mass mobilization to stop the scabs from crossing. Of course, the pickets on the river have been stopped by the Coast Guard, militarization, you know, use of U.S. military to stop pickets. And, of course, the scabs are from this Gettier security outfit, which comes from Texas and has these huge guys. Clearly a real challenge, but it's not been met. I'd just like to move on to talking about split from the AFL-CIO, which the reason is because of the IBEW crossing the picket lines and master's mates and pilots and the operating engineers. But the ILWU has never had a close relationship with the AFL-CIO. In fact, it didn't join the AFL-CIO until 1988, you know, long after the AFL-CIO was formed in 1954. In fact, the ILWU was kicked out of the CIO because of being a communist-led union. As Mark Brenner says in his article in the Labor Notes, leaving the Federation, as the ILWU is doing, is no substitute for spelling out a strategy to beat back the emboldened employers, keeping automation from sapping union power, or stopping concessions from spreading.
That was Jamie Partridge, presenting to Portland State University. Now another voice on the ILWU struggle, Joe Burns, talks to Megan about what's at stake for the labor movement today.
My name's Joe Burns. I'm a labor attorney and negotiator and the author of Reviving the Strike.
Can you tell us a little bit about the recent announcement by the Longshore Union?
The Longshore Union, which represents workers at the ports on the West Coast, announced that they were disaffiliating from the AFL-CIO and sent a letter to that effect to AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka. last week. And what the letter said was that they were upset because the AFL-CIO was not taking action against affiliates who were raiding the ILWU, the Longshore Workers Union's jurisdiction up and down the coast, up and down the West Coast. So, for that reason, and then they also listed some other reasons, such as the AFL-CIO's weak positions on healthcare and so forth for disaffiliating.
Joe, you've been writing for the last several years about the need for the labor movement to embrace the kind of tactics that made our movement strong in the past. And ILWU has been a union that has held on to the tried and true model of unionism that works, density and wielding the strike. So what does this mean exactly?
Yeah, I mean, really, what's at stake here? You know, some people may look at what's going on with the Longshore Union and think, well, it's really they're fighting some other unions about jobs, about who's going to control particular jobs in particular ports, but that's not really the issue. The issue is whether the form of unionism that the ILWU fought to establish in the 1930s and have held on to and fought to maintain for the last 80-some years is going to remain in effect. And the key part of that is that they've been able to establish control over labor, over their work in the ports coastwide. So all up and down the Pacific coast, they fought to maintain that all workers would work under the same contract and the same standards. What you see in recent years is an attempt by certain employers, certainly supported by the National Labor Relations Board and, you know, based on years of anti-union decisions, but most disturbingly, other trade unions to basically undercut those standards and break away parts of the longshore work under what, you know, I think the longshore workers would say would be sweetheart contracts that were inferior and really have the potential in the long term to undercut the ILWU and, you know, worsen conditions for everybody. You know, I think this disaffiliation should be an opportunity to really stand back and have a discussion over the fundamentals of trade unionism, because I think what ILWU is saying to the AFL-CIO is they need their support to maintain one of the strongholds of unionism in the United States. And while it's fine and dandy for the AFL-CIO to talk about, you know, partnerships and all that, this is a key area of unionism, and they have a lot to learn from this discussion. I think the, you know, a lot of the discussion we've seen lately, and I think that will be centered on at the convention, is pretty focused far away from the workplace and even, you know, traditional trade union objectives like, you know, organizing industry and maintaining standards and raising wages throughout industries.
So, Joe, how does what's happening now to the ILWU compare to what has happened in other industries?
If you look at various industries, and you can take, you know, trucking, manufacturing, you can take construction work, you know, really across the board, one of the key ways that management was able to defeat unionism was through corporate shell games and through use of the corporate form. And by that, I mean, traditionally, if you look at unions from the 1930s, well, even before, but through the 1930s, through the 1970s, they were able to build these strong multi-employer contracts that basically covered all of the workers in a given industry, and it leveled the wages. And in order to enforce them, they used strikes and so forth to win their demands. But a key component was that they were operating on an industry-wide basis, and that prevented individual employers from undercutting other employers and so forth. So one of the key features of the anti-union offensive of the 1970s, 80s, and beyond was to use a series of Supreme Court decisions that really were pro-employer, and that they allowed basically, you know, what we could call corporate shenanigans or corporate shell games to defeat unionism. So if you look at certain industries like janitorial services, they got hit with subcontracting, where you'd have a union contract, but then they would just you know, get rid of it, contract out. You'd get Supreme Court saying, well, even though the contract says that the successor employer is supposed to honor it, they don't have to. So you get a series of decisions like that in janitorial services, hotels, construction really got hit with a whole series of rules and use of, you know, subcontractors. So basically that's really been a key part of busting unions in industry after industry. So when you look at what's going on with the longshore workers right now, that's why people should be alarmed and take their complaints very seriously, because they're one of the few unions that, you know, probably really get it. And what they're saying is, and what their president of the ILWU says in his letter, is that, you know, they view all of these attacks as coordinated attacks on their jurisdiction. And I think what they see is the same, they're trying to prevent the same process that corporate America has been able to use in all of these other industries. And that's why they really need our support. And that's why this should really prompt a bigger discussion in the labor movement about, you know, what does it mean to really, you know, have effective trade unionism? And, you know, how does the law prevent that? How does unions undercutting under unions, you know, help prevent that? And those are really the issues that I think we need to be talking about. A lot of the local unions, you know, the immediate area, Oregon and Portland, I think have been supportive of the longshore workers, and, you know, which is a union that has a, you know, strong record of solidarity in the area. One of the disturbing things was that AFL-CIO apparently said there was an article in Labor Notes saying that they're not going to issue solidarity charters to the ILWU, which, you know, in the past when there was the breakaways with SEIU and the other unions that left the AFL-CIO, they allowed them to still participate in central labor unions. So I think one of the questions for trade unionists will be, you know, how do you maintain those ties even if they're not, if they're not participating in the formal labor movement? You know, so that's one thing. And then I think the other thing is, you know, I think it's an important opportunity to get the discussion going, to have conversations about what this means and really take the time to understand it.
Thank you, Joe.
Thanks.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, and this is Labor Radio. I'm in studio with Seamus Cook, a social worker, Portland native, and contributing author to websites including Counterpunch and Truth Out. He's been writing about labor and the Middle East for the last 5 years. Seamus, welcome to Labor Radio.
Thank you, Megan.
What should we know? What are the kind of top things that working people and voters should know about this country and why we're going to war?
Well, I think people need to know, first of all, that Syria is a very crucial centerpiece of the Middle East for Middle Easterners. It's a very vital country due to its history involving Islam and also its history involving Arab unity.
So let's start with some of the basics. Whereabouts is Syria located on the map?
Syria is smack dab in the Middle East, part of the Levant area, they call it. It borders Israel, Jordan, Turkey, Iraq, and Lebanon.
You know, what kind of folks live there? What's the ethnic and religious makeup of the country?
Syria, it's a very complex mixture of ethnicities and religions, and that's what makes it so combustible of a country, which is why we shouldn't be bombing them. The president is of Syria is a Shia Alawite. Alawite is a sect of Shiism, of Islam, and the majority of people in Syria are Sunni. But it's also, there's a population of Kurds and Christians, and, you know, these overlap, of course, you know, and there's even other smaller minority groups as well. So in modern history, Syria has a very important role to play in Middle East politics, most notably in its relation to opposing Israeli expansion. Israel and Egypt and Syria fought several wars, Egypt and Syria against Israel. And in fact, Israel's expansion caused a movement of Arab unity across the Middle East, which Syria co-led with Egypt, the apex of which happened in 1958 when Egypt and Syria combined into one country that lasted a short while for 3 years.
What should we know about the recent events in Syria that might be contributing to the political situation now?
Well, I think it's important to mention that the events in Syria were in part due to the world economy crumbling. So unemployment rose in Syria. There was droughts in the countryside, which led to discontent. And this was a major factor in the unpopularity of the president at that time, which caused some protests against President Bashar Assad.
And Syria is an oil-producing country, isn't that correct?
It's true, and it was a major oil producer until the last 10, 20 years or so. The oil deposits have been being used up. So Syria has been forced by a lack of other options to, and especially after the Soviet Union collapsed, to follow the American model of neoliberal policies, which was also a major contributor to the discontent in Syria.
Can you speak to some of the neoliberal policies that we might be familiar with here?
Oh, I think the main one is probably privatization. Syria still has a large public sector, but the privatization of this public sector caused a lot of layoffs, it caused unemployment, it lowered wages, and these general economic problems were part of the issues that led to the discontent.
So the drumbeats for war are sounding. What's Obama doing right now?
Well, it's very fascinating because in many ways Obama is following the footsteps of Bush. Like Bush, Obama is saying that the UN will not decide what will happen. Obama will decide. Obama's not going to wait for the UN inspectors to decide what happened in relation to the chemical weapons attack. He's going to decide based on his own evidence. So, of course, he can't be trusted about his evidence because he's been backing the Syrian rebels for the last 2 years against the Syrian government. So he has a very biased reason not to give us objective evidence about this issue.
What's not being talked about in the mainstream media?
Well, so much is not being talked about. For one, the main thing I think that's really important is that Obama is using the chemical weapons attack as a pretext for launching a war. And he's not calling it a war, but when you launch missiles into another country, that is by definition an act of war. Obama also has not mentioned that UN chemical weapons specialist Carla Del Ponte has suggested before that she believes the Syrian rebels are responsible for a prior chemical weapons attack. So this one-sided argument that it has to be the Syrian government is a lie, essentially.
Seamus, it's unclear what the Obama administration is after here. It's quite opaque what their goals for intervention would be. Do you think the ultimate goal is regime change?
Well, that's been the goal for a very long time. Obama has been backing a group of exiles in Syria that he refers to as the legitimate government of Syria. He said several times Assad must go. He is backing the Syrian rebels with arms, with training, with money. So it's really fantastic to believe that this bombing is disconnected from this policy that's been ongoing for the past 2 years, which is an explicit policy of regime change.
So what are the alternatives to this military intervention, Seamus? I mean, we know that the civil war is producing hundreds of thousands of casualties. This is a tragedy. What is the international community to do? Stand by and watch?
That's a great question, and it points to how this debate has been framed in the media in the most awful way. The most common sense solution is for foreign countries to stop flooding Syria with money, guns, and resources to the rebels who are fueling this conflict. If the U.S. government and its allies, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar, had stopped doing this 2 years ago, this conflict would have ended, and 90,000 lives would have been spared. Instead, we're fueling this conflict. It could go on for years to come at this rate. So that really is the answer. Stop throwing fighters and resources and money into Syria. Well, I think every Middle Eastern country has a duty, and it's their right to be able to work out the situation in their country for themselves. Egypt, for example, they've toppled two governments by massive protests in the streets. You have the example of Tunisia, very similar. If we withdraw our aid to the rebels, either the rebels will have popular support and overthrow the Assad regime on their own, or the Assad regime will have enough popular support to defeat the rebels. That's the dynamics of politics, really. Is there really a revolution in Syria? We'll see, maybe, if we withdraw our resources and the people unite against Assad. But it's a myth to say that they need an armed intervention to overthrow a government.
What do you think about a diplomatic solution to the situation in Syria?
Well, I think there's many options. For example, Russia and the United States have long talked about a peace conference about Syria. They call it Geneva II. That hasn't happened in part because the rebels in Syria won't participate. And they won't participate because they're losing the war. And any peace treaty that will come out of that will reflect kind of the forces on the ground. So you need the actors involved in the drama to participate in any peace conference. And unless they're all willing to participate, you can't have a real solution that way.
What do you think is at stake domestically?
So on a domestic level, there's many reasons to oppose this war. I think fundamentally this is an issue of priorities. Our nation doesn't have a limitless amount of money that we can use on whatever. So what are our priorities in this country? Is it going to be education? Is it going to be jobs? Or is it going to be bombing people in other countries for no good reason? We have a jobs crisis right now in this country, and we're told there's no money for a massive jobs program, for example, which could fund public works and put people back to work. We're laying off teachers all over the country. We're laying off public employees. We're attacking wages and pensions and health care of public employees. So our priorities are totally backwards here in this country. And unless we demand in a united way that there be no war in Syria and that we instead focus on our country to make jobs and public services available to all, then we're going to be stuck in this pattern that is going to keep on going. You know, we've already invaded Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya, now Syria. When does it stop? So we have to refocus our priorities. The labor movement has a responsibility to do that, to protect its voice. And I think in doing so, it will rally the country.
Seamus, Labor Radio is a show of, by, and for working people. How can we be in solidarity with workers in Syria?
Well, people who aren't in unions could definitely attend hands-off Syria protests that are happening in Portland. Those in unions could also help by passing resolutions in their union to say hands-off Syria. And instead, let's focus on building this country's infrastructure. Let's focus on building a jobs program that puts people back to work. Let's focus on rebuilding the social fabric that's been torn by austerity and these ongoing cuts.
Seamus, any last words?
Yes, I would just say that, you know, this is a crucially historic moment where your voice is needed in the streets. The only way to stop this war is if we have enough people in the streets that Obama worries about his domestic issues. So let's get people in the streets to say, hands off Syria, let's stop this war in its tracks.
The president speaking, 50 years to the day. The great man were here now, what would he say? With all the people in prison, and all the kids in the street, with the Navy sending in the Fifth Fleet. The president speaking, know how things change. Now it's Syria, not Vietnam, in the firing range. Every hour or so, I look at my phone to see if we've sent in the cruise missiles and drones. Has the bombing begun? Have we failed again to stop the war machine from killing more innocent children? The president speaking in the August sunshine. Turn on the TV, you won't find a sign that there's something ironic, that it should be now, that we're waiting to find out precisely how the buildings will fall and the people will die. The fathers will hold their lifeless children and cry. How could they do this? Did they accomplish their task? So at the top of each hour, I ask, has the bombing begun? Have we failed again to stop the war machine from killing innocent children? See the rest. refugees streaming, even more than last week. Kids too traumatized, even to speak, hoping to find somewhere, maybe a tent, wondering where their hopes and dreams all went. There's a demo this evening, as the missiles rain down, I and some others will head into the center of town. Bear witness again to unspeakable crime, and ask the terrible question one more time. Has the bombing begun? Have we failed again to stop the war machine from killing more innocent children? Has the bombing begun? Have we failed again to stop the war machine from killing more innocent children? Has the bombing begun?
That was David Rovick's Has the Bombing Begun? For more protest songs and information, you can visit davidrovics.com.
Thanks for listening to Labor Radio. Up next, Prison Pipeline.
Wednesdays in Portland are a little more festive these days, thanks to Creative Collaborations and Hump Day PDX. Hump Day PDX is a street festival in Southeast Portland, featuring the live music and art exhibits of creative entrepreneurs who are living on the streets. There are also family activities to enjoy, food to eat, and a beer garden for drink, all organized by Creative Collaborations in support of struggling artists and in an effort to stimulate the local neighborhood economy. The next Hump Day PDX is September 11th from 7 to 10 p.m. at Southeast 9th and Belmont in Portland. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at KBOO.com.